Masquerade of a Dead Sword, a Tragedy. When the world uncovers some dark disguise, embrace the darkness with averted eyes. Psalms of the Silent. 1. Faliol's Rescue. No doubt the confusions of Carnival Night were in some measure to blame for many unforeseen incidents. Every violation of routine order was being committed by carousing masses, their high-register songs of celebration harmonizing with a low-droning pedal point, which seemed to be sustained by the night itself. Having declared their town an enemy of quiescence, the people of Soldori had taken to the streets. There they conspired against solitude, and to accompanying gyrations of squealing abandon, sabotaged monotony. Even the Duke, a cautious man and one not normally given to those extravaganzas perpetrated by his counterparts in Lyness or Darenzella, was now holding a lavish masquerade, if only as a strategic concession to his subjects. Of all the inhabitants of the three towns, those under the rule of the Duke of Soldori, occasionally to the Duke's dismay, were the most loving of amusement. In every quarter of their usually sedate principality, frolicking merrymakers combed the night for a new paradise, and were as likely to find it in a blood match as in a bewitching countenance. All seemed anxious, even frantic, to follow blindly the entire spectrum of diversion, to dawdle about the lines between pain and pleasure, to obscure their vision of both past and future. So three well-drunk and hog-faced men, seated in a roisterous hostelry, might well be excused for not recognizing Faliol, whose colors were always red and black. But this man, who had just entered the thickish gloom of that drinking house, was garbed in a craze of colors, none of them construed to a pointed effect. One might have described this outfit as a motley gone mad. Indeed, what lay beneath this fool's patchwork were the familiar blacks and reds that no other of the three towns, neither those who were dandies, nor those who were sword whores, nor even those who, like Faliol himself, were both, would have dared to duplicate. But now these notorious colors were buried under a rainbow of rags which were tied about the man's arms, legs, and every other part of his person, seeming to hold him together like torn strips hurriedly applied to the storm-fractured joists of a sagging roof. Before he had closed the door of that cave-like room behind him, the draft rushing in from the street made his frayed livery come alive like a mass of tattered flags flapping in a calamitous wind. But even had he not been cast as a tatterdemalion, there was still so much else about Faliol that was unlike his former self. His sword, a startling length of blade, bobbed about unbuckled at his left side. His dagger, whose sheath bore a mirror of polished metal, which now seemed a relic of more dandified days, was strung loosely behind his left shoulder, ready to fall at any moment. And his hair was trimmed monkishly close to the scalp, leaving little reminder of a gloriously hirsute era. But possibly the greatest alteration, the greatest problem and mystery of Faliol's travesty of his own image, was the presence on his face of a pair of spectacles. And given that these spectacles were darkly tinged, as though fashioned from some murky substance, the eyes behind them were obscured. Still, there remained any number of signs by which a discerning scrutiny could have identified the celebrated Faliol. For as he moved toward a seat adjacent to the alcove where the booming-voiced trio was ensconced, he strode with a scornful, somehow involuntary, assuredness of which no reversals of fate could completely unburden him. And his boots, though their fine black leather had gone gray with the dust of roads that a zealous equestrian such as Faliol would never have trod, still jangled with a few of those once innumerable silver links from which dangled small agate-eyed medallions, ones identical to the onyx-eyed amulet which in other days hung from a silver chain around his lean throat. Now, however, no medallion ornamented Faliol's chest, and since he had lost or renounced the inkish eye of onyx, he had acquired two eyes of shadowed glass. Each lens of the spectacles reflected like twin moons the glow of the lantern above the place where Faliol seated himself, as if unaware that he was not settled in some cloistered cell of lucubration. He removed from somewhere within his shredded clothes a small book having the words Psalms of the Silent inscribed upon its soft, worn cover. And the cover of the book was black, while the characters of its title were the red of autumn leaves. Faliol? A scholar? Someone whispered in the crowded depths of the room, while another added,
And a scholar of his own grief, so I've heard.
Faliol unfixed the tiny silver clasp and opened the book somewhere toward its middle, where a thin strip of velvet marked his place. And if there had been a miniature mirror bound in place of the book's left-hand leaf, Faliol could have seen three thuggish men gazing mutely, not to say thoughtfully, in his direction. Moreover, if there had been a second mirror set at the same angle on the book's right-hand leaf, he could also have noticed a fourth pair of eyes spying on him from the other side of the hostelry's engrimed window panes. But there were only stern-looking letters written, to be precise, handwritten, in Faliol's own hand, upon the opposing leaves of the book. Thus, Faliol could not have seen either of these parties who, for reasons separate or similar, were observing him. All he saw were two pale pages, elegantly dappled by somber verses. Then a shadow passed across these pages, and another. The three men were now standing evenly spaced before Faliol, though he continued to read as if they were not present. He read until the lantern above was extinguished, its stump of tallow snuffed out by the middleman's grossly knuckled stumps of flesh. Clasping his book closed, Faliol replaced it within the rags around his heart and sat perfectly still. The three men seemed to watch in a trance of ugsome hilarity at this slowly and solemnly executed sequence of actions. The face at the window panes merely pressed closer to witness what, in its view, was a soundless scene. Some words of insult appeared to be aimed at the man in rags by the three men standing before him. The first of them splashed some ale upon the bespectacled personage, as did the second man from his enormous tankard. Then more ale, this time expectorated, was received by the victim as the third man's contribution to what became a series of petty torments. But Faliol remained silent and as motionless as possible, thereby expressing an attitude of mind and body which seemed only to provoke further the carnival-mad souls of the three Soldorians. As the moments passed, the men waxed more cruel and their torments more inventive. Finally, they jostled a bloody-mouthed Faliol out of his seat. Two of them pinioned him against the planks of the wall, while the trio's hulking third member snatched his spectacles. A pair of blue eyes was suddenly revealed. They firmly clenched themselves closed, then reopened as if bursting out of black depths and into the light. Faliol dropped to his knees, and his mouth stretched wide to let out a strangled scream, the scream of a mute under torture. But very soon his features relaxed, while his ragged chest began pumping up and down with an even rhythm. He rose to his feet. The one who had taken Faliol's spectacles had turned away, and his clumsy fingers were fiddling with delicate silver stems, fumbling with two shadowy lenses that were more precious than he knew. Thus amused and diverted, he did not perceive that Faliol had drawn his dagger from its shoulder sheath and was cutting away at his companions with stealth and savagery. "Where?" he started to shout to his loutish comrades as they ran ripped and bloody from the hostelry. Then he turned about face to feel Faliol's sword against his greasy leather doublet. He saw, he must have seen, that the blade was unclean but very sharp, and he must have felt it scrape playfully against the chainmail vest concealed beneath his doublet's sorry cover. Soon Faliol was lowering his blade until it reached the spot where the vest's protection no longer protected. "Now, put them on, that you might see," he instructed the giant, who held what appeared in his hands to be tiny toy spectacles. "Put them on," he repeated in the toneless voice of one who was dead to all appeasement or mercy. The giant, his lip-licking tongue visibly parched, obeyed the command. Upon doing so, his body went rigid and became as if fastened to the floor on which it stood. Everyone in the room leaned closer to see the giant in dark spectacles. And so did the well-groomed face at the hostelry window. Most of the men laughed, drunkenly and anonymously, but a few remained silent, if they did not in fact become silent at this sight.
"And a scholar of the wildest folly, too," someone whispered.
Faliol himself grinned like a demon, his eyes widening at his work. After a few moments, he returned his sword to its sheath, and even so, the giant held his transfixed position. Faliol put away his dagger, and the giant did not budge a hair. Trapped within himself, he stood with paralyzed arms hanging beside his enormous flanks. The giant's face was extraordinarily pale, his grizzled cheeks like two mounds of snow that had been sown with ashes. Above them, circles of glass gleamed like two black suns. All laughter had ceased by now, and many turned away from the unwanted spectacle. The giant's meaty lips were the only part of him that moved, though very slowly and very much in the manner of a dying fish gasping in the dry air. But having seen through Faliol's spectacles, the giant was not dying in his body. Only his mind was a corpse.
"The wildest folly," whispered the same voice.
Gently, almost contritely, Faliol removed the spectacles from the face of the dumbstruck idol, and he waited until he was outside the hostelry before replacing them on his own.
"Good sir," called a voice from the shadows of the street.
Faliol paused, but only as if considering the atmosphere of the night, and not necessarily in response to a stranger who had accosted him.
Please allow me to identify myself with the name Streldoni. I assume my messenger spoke with you last eve in Lyness. How generous of you to come to Soldori to meet with me. Well then, here is my coach, he said, so that we need not talk in all the confusion of Carnival night. And when the coach began moving down streets on the circumference of the festivities, this finely habited gentleman, though he was just barely more than a youth, continued to speak to a silent Faliol. I was informed you had arrived in Soldori not long before this very moment, and have been waiting for a discreet interval in which to approach you. Of course you are aware of my presence, he said, pausing to scan Faliol's expressionless face. How unfortunate that you were forced to reveal who you are back in that sty of a drinking house. But I suppose you couldn't allow yourself to undergo much more of that treatment merely for the sake of anonymity. No harm done, I'm sure.
And I am sure, Faliol replied in a monotone, that three very sad men would disagree with you.
The young man laughed briefly at what he understood to be a witticism. In any event, their kind will have their throats wrapped in the red cord sooner or later. The Duke is quite severe when it comes to the lawlessness of others. Which brings me to what I require of you tonight, presuming that we need not bargain over the terms my messenger proposed to you in Lyness. Very well, said Streldoni, though obviously he had been prepared to haggle over the matter. But he left no pause which might have been filled with the second thoughts of this hired sword, who looked and acted more like one of the clockwork automatons which performed their mechanical routines high above the town square of Soldori. Thus, with a slow turn of his head and a set movement of his hand, Faliol received the jeweled pouch containing one half his payment. Streldoni promised that the other portion would follow upon the accomplishment of their night's work, as he now portrayed its reasons and aims. It seemed there was a young woman of a noble and wealthy family, a princess in all but title, whom Streldoni loved and who loved him in return, accepting his proposal of marriage and cleaving to his vision of their future as two who would be one. But there was also another, who was called Winge, though Streldoni referred to him thereafter as the sorcerer. As Streldoni explained the situation, the sorcerer had appropriated the young woman for himself. This unnatural feat was achieved, Streldoni hated to say, not only through the powerful offices of the Duke of Soldori himself, but also with the willing compliance of the young woman's father. Both men, according to Streldoni, had been persuaded in this affair because the sorcerer had promised to supply them, by means of alchemical transmutations of base metals into gold and silver, with an unending source of riches to finance their wars and other undertakings of ambition. Without bothering to embellish the point, Streldoni declared that he and his beloved, in their present state of separation, were two of the most wretched beings in the world, and desperate for assistance in their struggle to be reunited. And that carnival night would be the last opportunity for Faliol to untangle them from the controlling strings of the sorcerer and his compatriots. "Do I have your attention, sir?" Streldoni asked. Faliol vouchsafed his understanding of the matter by repeating to its last detail Streldoni's account of his plight. "Well, I am glad to know that your wits are still in order, however distracted you may seem. I have heard certain rumors, you understand. In any event, tonight the sorcerer is attending the Duke's masquerade at the palace. She will be with him. Help me steal her back, so that we may both escape from Soldori, and I will fill the empty part of that pouch." Faliol asked if Streldoni had possessed the foresight to have brought along a pair of costumes to enable their entrance to the masquerade. Streldoni, somewhat vainly, produced from the shadows of the coach two such costumes, one that was appropriate to a knight of the old days, and the other that of a court jester of the same period. Faliol reached out for the wildly patterned costume with the jeering mask. "But I am afraid," said Streldoni, "that I intended that costume for myself. The other is more suited to allow your sword..."
"No sword will be needed," Faliol assured his nervous companion. "This will be fitting," he added, holding the hook-nosed fool's face opposite his own.
They were now traveling in the direction of the palace, and Soldori's carnival began to thicken about the wheels of Streldoni's coach. Gazing upon the nocturnal confusion, Faliol's eyes were as dark and swirled with shadows as the raving night itself. 2. The Story of the Spectacles. His eyes fixed and clouded as a blind man's, the mage sat before a small circular table upon which a single wax taper burned in a silver stick. Illuminated by that modest flame, the surface of the table was inlaid with esoteric symbols, a constellation of designs which reduced essential forces of existence to a few rather picturesque patterns. But the mage was not occupied with these. He was simply attending to someone who was raving in the shadows of a secret chamber. The hour was late, and the night was without a moon. The narrow window behind the beardless, pallid face of the mage was a solid sheet of blackness that seemed to absorb the candlelight. Every so often, someone would move before this window, his hands running through his thick, dark hair as he spoke or tried to speak. Occasionally, he would move toward the candle flame, and a glimpse could be caught of his bold attire in blacks and reds, his shining blue eyes, his fevered face. Calmly, the mage listened to the man's wild speech. "Not if I have become mad, but of what my madness consists is the knowledge I seek from you. And please understand that I have no hopes, only a searing curiosity to riddle the corpse of my dead soul. As for the assertion that I have always been engaged in deeds which one might deem mad, I would be obliged to answer, yes, countless deeds, countless mad games of flesh and steel. Having confessed that, I would also avow that these were sanctioned provocations of chaos, known in some form to the body of the world and even blessed by it, if the truth be spoken. But I have provoked another thing, a new madness which arrives from a world that is on the wrong side of light, a madness that is unsanctioned and without the seal of our natural selves. It is a forbidden madness, a saboteur from outside the body of known laws. And as you know, I have been the subject of its devastation. Since the madness began working its ruin upon me, I have become an adept of every horror which can be thought or sensed or dreamed. In my very dreams, have I not told you of them? There are scenes of slaughter without purpose, without constraint, and without end. I have crept through dense forests, not of trees, but of tall pikes planted in the earth, and upon each of them a crudely formed head has been fixed. These heads all wear faces which would forever blind the one who saw them anywhere but in a dream. And they follow my movements not with earthly eyes, but with shadows rolling in empty sockets. Sometimes the heads speak as I pass through their uncanny ranks, telling me things I cannot bear to hear. Nor can I shut out their words, and I listen until I've learned the horrors of each brutal head. And the voices from their lacerated mouths, so clear, so precise to my ears that every word is a bright flash in my dreaming brain, a brilliant new coin minted for the treasure house of hell. At the end of the mad dream, these heads endeavor to laugh, creating a blasphemous babble which echoes throughout that terrible forest. And when I awaken, the night continues to reverberate with fading laughter. Yet why should I speak of waking from these dreams? For to awaken, as I once understood this miracle, means to reclaim a world of laws which for a time were lost, to rise into the light of the world as one falls into the darkness of dream. But for me, there is no sense of breaking through the envelope of sleep. It seems that I remain a captive of these dreams, these visions. For when one leaves off, another begins, like a succession of connected rooms which will never lead to freedom. And for all I can know, I am even now the inhabitant of one of these rooms. And at any moment, I beg forgiveness, wise man. You may transform into a demon and begin to disembowel weeping children before my eyes and smear their entrails upon the floor so that in them you may read my future, a future without escape from those heads and from what comes after. For there is a citadel in which I am a prisoner and which holds within it a type of school, a school of torture. Ceremonial stranglers, their palms grooved by the red cord, stalk the corridors of this place or lie snoring in its shadows, dreaming of perfect throats, and somewhere the master carnifex, the supreme inquisitor, waits as I am taken from my cell and dragged across stone floors until I am finally presented to this fiend with witless rolling eyes. And my arms, my legs, everything is shackled, and I am screaming to die while the torture of the question.
Enough, said the mage without raising his voice.
Yes, enough, the madman said, and so I have said numberless times. But there is no end, there is no hope. And this endless, hopeless torment incites me with a desire to turn its power on others, and even to dream of turning it on all, to see the world drown in oceans of agony as the only vision which now brings me any relief from my madness, from a madness which is not of this world.
Though neither is it of any other world, said the mage in the same quiet voice.
But I have also had visions of butchering the angels, replied the madman, as if to argue the irreparable nature of his mania.
You have envisioned precisely what you have been made to envision, and nothing that has risen from your own true being. But how could you have known this, when it is the nature of what you have seen, this anima mundi, of the oldest philosophers and alchemists, to deceive and to pose as the soul of another world, and not as the soul of the world we know. There is only one world, and one soul of that world, which appears in forms of beauty or bravery or madness, according to how anima mundi would turn you. And no ordinary devising may turn you away from what it wills. This is the power that has made you what you now are, and would unmake you for its own design. It has played with you as it would a puppet.
Then I will make myself its destruction.
You cannot. Your very wish to destroy it is not yours, but that of the thing itself. You are not who you are. You are only what it would have you be.
You speak as if it were a god of deceit and illusion. There is no other or truer way to speak of it. But no further words now, finished the mage. He then instructed the madman to seat himself at the table of arcane designs and to wait there with eyes calmly closed. And for what remained of that moonless night, the mage worked in another part of his dwelling, returning to the wretched dreamer just before dawn. In one of his hands was the product of his labors, a pair of strangely darkened spectacles, as if they had shadows sealed within them. These he fitted to the madman's face.
"Do not yet open your eyes, my unhappy friend, but heed my words. I know the visions you have known, for they are among the visions that all were born to know. There are eyes within our eyes, and when these others open, all becomes confusion. The meaning of my long life consists of the endeavor to seize and settle these visions until my natural eyes themselves have altered in accordance with my purpose. Now, for what reason I cannot say, Anima Mundi has revealed itself to you in its most essential aspect, that of chaos at feast. Having seen the face behind all its others, your life can never again be as you have known it. All the pleasures of the past are now defiled, all your hopes violated beyond hope. There are things which only madmen fear because only madmen may truly conceive of them. Your world is presently black with the scars of madness, but you must make it blacker still in order to find any solace. You have seen both too much and not enough. Through the shadow-fogged lenses of these spectacles, you will be blinded so that you may see with greater sight. Through their darkly clouded glass, Anima Mundi will diffuse into nothingness before you. What would murder another man's mind will bring yours peace. Henceforth, all things will be in your eyes a distant play of shadows that fretfully strive to engage you, ghosts that clamor to pass themselves as actualities, masks that desperately flit about to conceal the stillness of the void behind them. Henceforth, I say, all things will be reduced in your eyes to their inconsequential essence. And all that once shined for you, the steel, the stars, the eyes of another, will lose its luster and take its place among the other shadows. All will be dulled in the power of your vision, which will give you the ability to see that the greatest power, the only power, is to care for nothing. Please know that this is the only means by which I may help you. You have been made ready to receive this salvation by your very torments. Though we cannot overthrow the hold that Anima Mundi has on the others of this earth, we must still try as we can. For as long as the soul of the world has its way, it will grieve all in whom it lives. But it will not live in you, on the condition you obey one simple rule. You must never be without these spectacles, or your furies will return to you. There, now you may open your eyes.
Faliol sat very still for some time, an ease of heart within him as he gazed through the spectacles. At first he did not notice that one of the mage's own eyes was closed, covered by a sagging eyelid. When at last he saw this and perceived the sacrifice, he said,
"And how may I serve you, wise man?"
Beyond the window, at the back of the two figures,
Something seemed to be at watch. Neither man took note of the image, which was so obscure as to be nearly invisible. Some would call it a face, yet its features were translucent, such that not even the sharpest eye could read them clearly. Nor could any eye outside that room where Faliol and the mage sat quietly conversing suffer to behold such a vision. 3. Anima Mundi. While the revelers in the streets of Soldori remedied their discontents by throwing off the everyday face of orthodoxy, those attending the masquerade at the Duke's palace found their deliverance by donning other faces, other bodies, and perhaps other souls. The anonymity of that night, no unmasking was expected to be held, enabled a multitude of sins against taste, from the most subtle to the most grotesque indiscretions. The society of the court had transformed itself into a race of gods or monsters, competing at once with the brightest and highest of stars and the strangest of the world's lower creatures. Many would undoubtedly spend the succeeding days or weeks in darkened rooms behind closed doors so that the effects their disguises had wrought on their bodies might be known to none. For a few rare spirits, this by necessity would be their last appearance in the eyes of the court before a final seclusion. All were quite clearly arrayed, as if something unparalleled and possibly conclusive was to occur that night. Musicians played in several of the palace's most sumptuous and shimmering halls. Glittering glasses were filled by fountains of unnaturally colored wine, and maskers swarmed about like living gargoyles freed from the cathedral's stone. All, or nearly all, were straining for some unheard-of antic, suffering the pleasures of expectancy. But as the hours passed, hopes dissolved. The Duke, in essence a simple man, even a dull one, took no initiative to unloose the abundant possibilities of the masquerade, and as if instinctively aware of these perilous directions, he restrained the efforts of others to pursue them and thereby digress in a wayward manner from the night's steadily unwinding course. No petitioning could sway him. He allowed several odd witticisms to pass unacknowledged, and he feigned that certain dubious suggestions and proposals were abstruse to his mind. Unnourished by any source within the Duke's character, every attempt at innovation curled at its colorful edges and died. The initial strangeness of the masked gathering went stale. Voices began to sound as though they were transacting business of some tedious sort, and even the sight of a jester, albeit one with darkness within the eyes of his mask, offered no special merriment to this sullen assembly. Accompanying the jester, who made no lively movements, was a knight out of armor, dressed in radiant blues and golds, a crusader's cross emblazoned upon his chest, and over his face a white silk mask of blandly noble expression. The odd duo progressed from room to room of the palace, as if they were negotiating a thick wood in search of something or someone. The knight was manifestly nervous, his hand too obviously ready to go for the sword at his side, his head patrolling with skittish alertness the bizarre world around him. The jester, on the other hand, was altogether composed and methodical, and with excellent reason. He knew, as the knight did not, that their purpose was not a difficult one, as they would enjoy the complicity of Winge himself, whom the knight had called the sorcerer, but whom the jester knew to be the wise man mage in disguise. With this advantage, Faliol might easily assist the knight in escaping Soldori. Not that such heroics were any longer of concern to Faliol, who was merely serving the mage in a machination to break the duke. The alchemical transformation that the ruler desired would indeed take place, though not precisely as promised. What reserves of wealth the duke and his sorceress conspirator possessed would tonight undergo, per the plan of the mage, a reverse alchemy that would leave them paupers. And then his work would be done in Soldori, such as he could accomplish what he set out to do. The knight and the jester now paused at the arched entrance to the last and most intimate of the masquerade's many rooms. Pulling at the knight's golden sleeve, the jester angled his pointed, sneering muzzle toward a costumed pair in the far corner. The indicated figures were appareled as monarchs of the old days, a king and queen in ancient robes and stoles and many-horned crowns. "How can you be sure they're the ones?" whispered the knight to the buffoon at his side.
"Approach and take her hand. You will be sure. But say nothing until you have led yourselves back through these rooms and to freedom."
"But the king might well be the sorcerer in disguise," objected the knight. "He could have us both executed."
"Do as I tell you, though I cannot tell you all. You will see me greet the king and caper about as his jester. Believe me when I say that he is no sorcerer, only one who does what he can in this world against powers that can never be undone. And he has been working for your cause, even before you knew of its troubles. Trust me that all will be well."
"I do trust you," said the knight, as he furtively stuffed a jeweled pouch twice the size of the first into the belt of the jester, though Faliol cared nothing for the copious reward. The two characters separated and merged with the murmuring crowd. The jester arrived first at their destination. From a distance, he seemed to speak a few words into the king's ear, and then suddenly leaped back to play the fool before him, hopping about wildly. The knight bowed before the queen and then, without ostentation, led her away to other rooms. Though her mask covered the expression beneath it, the manner in which she placed her hand upon the knight's appeared to reveal her knowledge of his identity. After they had gone, the jester ceased his antics and stood close to the statue-like king.
"I shall watch the duke's men around us, who may have been watching you, wise man."
"And I shall see that our two little babes find their way through the forest," replied the mock monarch, who abruptly strode off.
"But that was not part of your design," thought Faliol.
And neither was the king's roguish voice, that of the solemn mage. The dark eyes of the jester's mask followed the movements of the impostor until he became lost in the throng. Faliol had just started in pursuit when a strange commotion in another part of the palace adduced much talk on all sides. It seemed that something unheard of had finally occurred, though it did not gladden any of those who had hoped for a unique happening on that carnival night. The disturbance originated in the centermost of that labyrinth of capacious rooms composing the arena of the masquerade. To the surrounding, as well as the more peripheral rooms, including the one in which Faliol was now caught by the crushing crowd, there first traveled what sounded like cries of amusement. These quickly transformed, however, into ambiguous outbursts of surprise unto the edge of shock. Finally, the uproar took on the character of intense horror, all voices in alarm and confusion. Tidings passed rapidly, though less and less reliably, from mouth to mouth, room to room. Something terrible had happened, something which had begun, or was initially perceived, as a fabulous hoax. No one knew exactly how it was possible, but there suddenly appeared an outlandish spectacle in the midst of the most congested room of that night's affair. The matter of the event was that two participants in the mask, without being spied by those around them, had donned costumes which went far beyond the most gruesome seen beforehand at the palace gathering. Among some persons, word circulated about semblances most closely akin to giant leeches or worms, for they did not walk upright, but writhed along the floor as if absent of bones. Others heard that these prodigies of disguise possessed countless tiny legs, and thus more properly resembled centipedes of some type. Still others averred that what was now in their company were not masqueraders, but things inhuman in nature, having many taloned claws, reptilian tails, serpent faces, and an overall composition of fantastical beasts which could not be dissembled by man nor woman. But whatever may have constituted the true substance and form of these beings, at some stage they affected the crowd with a panic past all reckoning. And however subsequent actions were construed to transpire, the consequence was that these bizarre intruders were hacked and torn and trampled owing to an unreasoning revulsion for their aspect, or many aspects. Tragically, once the massacre was accomplished, it was not the slaughtered remains of two uncanny monsters that the masqueraders, their masks removed, looked down upon. Instead, it was two of their own, a knight and queen of the old days, whose blood was spreading across the ornate designs of the palace floor. Their bodies, which they had feared would be lastingly parted, were now all but indistinguishable from each other. Throwing off his jester's face, Faliol worked himself near enough to the scene to view the horror with his own shaded eyes. A tragedy, yes, but not such that would return Faliol to his furies. For the image he saw immediately took its place among the seamless and unending flow of hellish idola which constituted anima mundi, and which, in his vision, was a monotonous tapestry of the terrible ceaselessly unfurling itself in the faintest shades of gray. Thus, the appalling tableau was neither more nor less sinister in his sight than any other which the world might show him.
"Look again, Faliol,"
said a voice at his back as a forceful boot propelled him toward the carnage. But why was everything painted with such brilliance now, when a moment ago it was all so insipid? Why did every piece of mutilated flesh pulse with color? And why was Faliol wholly benumbed by these red-smeared forms and their unhappy fate? He had been charged to save them, and he could do nothing. His thoughts were now careening wildly through crimson corridors within him, madly seeking solutions, but falling at every turn into blind corners and flailing in vain against something immovable, impossible. He pressed his hands over his face, hoping to blind himself to the scene, but everything remained invincibly there before his eyes, everything save his spectacles. Now the Duke's voice broke the brief lull of the dazed and incredulous assembly. The enraged sovereign shouted orders, demanded answers. How justified had proved his misgivings concerning the masquerade. He had long known that something of this nature might occur, and had done what he could to prevent its coming to pass. On the spot, he outlawed all future occasions of this kind and called for arrests and interrogations, the torture of the question to be liberally implemented. Exodus was instantaneous. The palace became a chaos of fleeing freaks. "Faliol!" called a voice that sounded too clear within all the confusion to have its origins outside his own mind. "I have what you're looking for. They're with me now, right here in my hand, not lost forever." When Faliol turned around, he saw the masked king standing some distance away, unmolested by the frantic mob. The king was holding out the spectacles as if they were the dangling head of a conquered foe. Fighting his way toward the unknown persecutor, Faliol would chase him down and reclaim sanity, though not before he had barbarously dispatched the fiend. Yet he could not catch up to this figure, which led him through all the rooms where the masquerade once flourished, and then deeper into the palace. At the end of a long, silent corridor, the gaudy, flapping train of a royal robe disappeared through a doorway. Faliol followed the shape and at last entered a dim chamber with a single window, before which stood the mummer who taunted him. The spectacles were still held by the velvet fingers of a tightly gloved hand. Watching as the dark lenses flashed in the candlelight, Faliol's eyes burned as much with questions as with madness. "Where is the mage?" he demanded. "The mage is no more." "Then tell me who are you before I send you to hell." "You know who I am. But say I'm a sorcerer, if that is well with you."
"And you killed the mage as you did the others?"
"The others? How could you have not heard that rattling pantomime? All those swords and swift feet. Did you not hear that there was a pair of Leviathan leeches, or something in that way, menacing the guests?" "True. I had a hand in the illusion, but my hand contained no gouging blade. A shambles. You saw it with your own eyes."
"In their fate, you saw your own future. Even a sorcerer may be killed."
"Agreed, though I think not by your hand."
"Who are you to have destroyed the mage?"
"In fact, he destroyed himself. A heroic act, I'm sure. And he did it before my own eyes, as if in spite. As for myself, I confess that I am disappointed to be so far beneath your recognition. We have met previously, please remember. But it was many years past, and I suppose you became forgetful as well as dim-sighted once you put those pieces of glass over your eyes. You see why the mage had to be stopped. He ruined you as a madman, as my madman. But you might recall that you had another career before the madness took you, did you not?
Brave Faliol.
Do you not remember how you were made as such? Do you not wish to remember that you were Faliol the Dandy before we met on the road that day? It was I, in my role as a charm seller, who outfitted you with that onyx-eyed amulet which you once wore around your neck. It was that bauble which made you the skillful mercenary you once were, and that you loved to be. And how everyone else loved you that way. To see a weakling
become a man of strength and of steel is the stuff of public comment, of legend, and of diversion in general. And how much more do they love to witness the reverse of this process, to see the mighty laid low, the lord of the sword made mad. This was the little drama I had planned. You were supposed to be my madman, Faliole, not the imperturbable fool of that magician. You were supposed to be a real lost soul of torments in red and black, not a pathetic monk chanting silent psalms in pale breaths. Do you not understand? It was Winge who ruined you, who undid all my schemes for your tragic and colorful history. Because of him, I was forced to change my plans, which are many and touch the lives of all. Yes, it was your mage who had wrested his soul from me and believed he could do the same for you. Blame him for the slaughter of those innocents and for what you are about to suffer. You know my ways. We are not strangers.
No, demon horror, we are not. You are indeed the foul thing the wise man described to me. All the dark powers which we cannot understand but only hate.
Poor Faliole. How wrong you are to contend that the one who stands before you is hated, whatever few enemies I may have.
Do you hear those rhapsodic voices in the streets below? They are not filled with hate.
Even when I excruciate them, they make excuses for me. They could not possibly hold a greater love for what gives them all they have, however little it may sometimes come to.
But I would never go so far that they would turn against their own perpetuity.
Only as they live do I live on. And the exceptional destinies of heroes and magicians, of kings and queens, saints and martyrs, these have special roles to perform in my scheme. From the highest to the lowest, they are all my children, and through their eyes I see my own glory.
You see but your own foulness.
No, the foulness is yours alone to lay eyes on, my dear Faliole. For those enamored of their continuance, no foulness exists.
You have worn these spectacles too long, and to my disappointment, still see too much.
You have seen me as others have not, if that pleases you, and for that you must come to an end.
This is a privileged doom for those such as yourself, a type of consolation.
You have said enough.
To be sure, my time is precious.
And yet I have not said what I came here to say,
or rather, to ask. You know the question. Do not deny it, Faliole. The one you dreamed in those mad dreams I sent you. The torture of the question you dreaded to hear asked and dreaded more to have answered.
Demon!
What is the face of the soul of the world?
No,
it is not a face. It is only...
Yes, there is a face, Faliole, and you will see it, said the masked figure as it peeled away its mask. But why have you hidden your eyes that way, Faliole? And why have you fallen to your knees? Do you not appreciate the vision I have shown you? Could you ever have imagined that your existence would lead you into the presence of such a sight? Your spectacles cannot save you now. They are only so much glinting glass. Hark to my grinding them underfoot upon the cool marble of the floor. No more spectacles, Faliole. And I think, too, no more Faliol. Can you understand what I am telling you now, Jester?
Well, what have you to say?
Nothing? How black your madness must be to make you so rude. How black!
But see, even if you will not, how I have provided these escorts to show you the way back to the carnival, which is where a buffoon belongs. And be sure that you make my legions of admirers laugh, or I will punish you.
Yes, I can still punish you, Faliol.
A living man can always be punished, so remember to be good.
I will be watching.
I am always watching. Farewell, then, fool. A glazen-eyed guard on either side of him, Faliol was dragged from the Duke's palace and given to the crowd which still rioted in the streets of Soldori. And the crowd embraced the mad jester, hoisting his jingling form upon their shoulders, shaking him like a toy as they carried him along. In its scheme to strangle silence forever, Soldori's unruly populace bellowed a robust refrain to Faliol's sickly moans. Into an onyx-black night, his eyes gazed and his mind vanished. But there must have been some moment, however brief, in which Faliol regained his old enlightenment, and which allowed him to accomplish such a crucial and triumphant action. Was it solely by his own sleeping strength, fleetingly aroused, that he attained his greatest prize? If not, then what power could have enabled his trembling hands to reach so deeply into those haggard sockets and with a gesture brave and sure dig out the awful seeds of his suffering? However it was done, the deed was done well. For as Faliol perished, his face was flushed with a crimson glory. And the crowd fell silent, and a new kind of confusion spread among them, those heads which were always watching, when it was found that what they were bearing through the streets of Soldori was only Faliol's victorious corpse.